Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Well, we've got a lot to discuss this week, and to start it off, we're at the Reporters Roundtable, where I am happy to be joined by my partner here at New York Now, Matt Ryan of WMHT, and Mike Gormley from Newsday. Well, gentlemen, the big news this week came out of Washington, but it has many, many implications for the state of New York. And that, of course, is passage of the American Health Care Act, which passed the House very narrowly on Thursday and now moves on to the U.S. Senate. Lots of things to unpack there, but we can probably start with the continued pushback from Democrats, especially from Governor Andrew Cuomo, who this week described the AHCA and President Donald Trump's larger budget plans as an arrow aimed at the heart of New York.
Just to keep it in perspective, there's a real question of whether this will get through the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
The Republican Congress had to pass this. It doesn't mean that this is going to become law. Having said that, this is a great a political opportunity for the governor and for New York state legislators, because health care is incredibly important in New York. They've got a lot of safeguards. They will attack what the Republican Congress has done. You'll hear an awful lot of rhetoric about this. But until we get a better idea of what's going to happen in the Senate, it's mostly going to be a lot of back and forth.
I think Tennessee's Lamar Alexander, the senator out there, yeah, I don't think he said DOA, but it is not going to be the same bill. So while it's going to be a great a campaign point for Democrats, certainly in 2018, but yeah, right now we have to see what the Senate's going to do.
We had at the Times Union, John Faso came in for an editorial board on Monday, quite literally just as he was about to get on a plane to go down to New York City. Faso, of course, a Republican from a very strange-shaped district, as many of them are, that runs through very purple district that runs through the Hudson Valley. And what he said straight up was, number one, he was willing to see it come out to the floor for a vote without a Congressional Budget Office score, which a lot of people are waiting for, that assesses kind of the social and fiscal impacts of the bill. And also, he said quite pointedly that this was necessary simply to get the bill to the Senate, that to get a flawed bill to the Senate where they could really go to work on it.
Right. And again, it's not the best way to do legislation, but there's an awful lot of politics wrapped into this. Mm-hmm. With President Trump promising to repeal and replace Obamacare, this is as close as they've come to doing this. It's a difficult situation for Republicans in New York State. How do you vote for this thing? Well, this vote wasn't as difficult if this was a more likely outcome for the Health Care Act. But, you've got Republicans who have to, like John Faso, who have to make a difficult decision. He came out very strongly through this thing. Mm-hmm. He actually raised his profile, his statewide profile, through this battle. So people are treading carefully, and it's an interesting thing to watch. But again, as Matt said, let's see what the Senate's going to do.
There was a clip yesterday going viral. Those of us on Twitter may have seen it. It was Paul Ryan, the just then a Wisconsin congressman in 2010, saying, "We shouldn't be voting on bills that we haven't seen, read, or scored." And, of course, talking about the Congressional Budget Office there, we shouldn't rush a health bill. I mean, obviously, we saw hypocrisy yesterday on display. The vote was very close, as Mike said, it was 217 to 213. And what does that mean? Well, a lot of Republicans in New York can really be hammered with that come 2018. We saw Nancy Pelosi said this is going to be tattooed on the foreheads of all the Republicans who are running in 2018. And I think it was the Democrats yesterday on the floor of the Congress singing that familiar tune at you sometimes hear at the end of a sports game, "Na na na na. Hey, 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 goodbye," meaning then don't get used to this position here, because in 2018 we're coming after you.
And as almost a sequel to that clip, the Ryan clip you were discussing, there has been another one going around more recent vintage of Chris Collins, who, of course, is a major Trump supporter from out Buffalo way, who admitted to Wolf Blitzer on CNN that, no, I didn't read this
whole bill. He didn't read the bill. He relied on his staff for this one. And what I'm really curious to see is what, you know, we're a long way away from 2018. A lot can happen. But what type of election cycle are we going to have? Are we going to see one like in 2010 and 2014 where Republicans picked up a lot of seats? Of course, there was a Democratic president. Or will we see something like 2006 when we had a unpopular Republican president and the Democrats, you know, swept to victory and they took the House? You know, are safe seats all of a sudden going to become not so safe? Forget about the moderate seats, the ones that swing back and forth. Maybe a seat like Chris Collins or maybe a Lee Zeldin over in the first district on the eastern end of Long Island. That's what I'm most interested in seeing.
Democrats are claiming they're going to win 20 seats, which I think is just, this is old speak. We're in a whole different political sphere now. That's something that you could have said, you know, two cycles ago. But the Republicans, most of the Republicans who voted for this had to vote for this. They're not going to get hurt in the reelection effort. What I'm interested in 2018 is to watch how Republicans rise from this, because and not for reelection, but for the governor's race. The Republicans are looking for someone to run against Andrew Cuomo. This was a key issue for them and for their constituents. This is a political opportunity for people to rise.
Oh, and of course, we should point out that most of the effects of the AHCA, or kind of the most daunting potentially effects of the AHCA, wouldn't go into effect until long down the road, like towards 2020. So you're not necessarily going to immediately, once again, it still needs to pass the Senate, but you're not going to see, for example, people immediately losing their health care, the Medicaid expansion immediately contracting, or that kind of thing. It's a slow speed movement.
Here's another interesting stat. 46 of the 61 Republicans in districts that voted either for Clinton or Obama at least once voted yes on the AHCA. So we'll see what happens there. Elise Stefanik, who represents the North Country, probably in a pretty safe district most of the time. She has a town hall coming up on Monday at her sister station, Mountain Lake PBS. The timing on that is something else, but we'll have that for you next week. But interesting to see how she answers her constituents' questions on this.
Moving closer to home here in Albany, the continued feud between Comptroller Tom DiNapoli and Governor Andrew Cuomo had sort of a good news, bad news week, I think it's fair to say, this week. The Comptroller's Office, after sort of careful consideration, approved $12.5 million for the purchase of a new helicopter for the governor. One of the helicopters that he had been using recently experienced some technical difficulties in midair a couple of months ago. So I'm sure the governor and his staff are very happy to be hearing about that. But the ongoing war of words over oversight, procurement reform, continues with the governor in a Q&A on Wednesday, asked about the proposals that are moving through the legislature for procurement reform, of course, in the wake of the scandal that has really engulfed upstate development projects. The governor said, "We've had a series of criminal violations. That's not an audit problem," clear shot at DiNapoli. "And if you try to treat it like an audit problem, that means you're avoiding what it is, which is a fraud and problem of criminality."
Well, the Comptroller DiNapoli, his argument to that is that he's not talking about just doing another audit, which is the way the governor tried to phrase this. Comptroller DiNapoli is saying he wants to restore, he wants to have his power restored to do pre-audits, which DiNapoli says will deter bad guys from trying to get into these things, trying to manipulate these contracts or to benefit from them unfairly. It will also point out problems early on. Now, under Governor Cuomo, the Comptroller's office lost some of its power to do this. The legislature seems to be in a mood to restore a lot of this. And this would be interesting because, again, what we're talking about mostly are the economic development programs that Governor Cuomo had pushed. Some of them were signature programs like the Buffalo Billion and involved two people that are longtime associates of his. And so this is why the need for or the cry for an independent outside review of these contracts is gaining steam now.
We've heard this story before of Cuomo and DiNapoli being at odds. DiNapoli, who, by the way, had just recently celebrated 10 years in office as controller, which is hard to believe. What was it? Cuomo in August said DiNapoli should educate himself on job creation incentives. I think that was after a startup audit. So it just continues between these two.
Speaking of the startup program and the larger question of state incentives, there was a report out this week from Pew that said that New York generally does a very poor job of checking up and assessing the value that New Yorkers are getting for the billions of dollars in tax incentives and other goodies that go out to private businesses.
Right. Not big news for all of us, because we've all done the stories on the lack of comparative lack of oversight, independent oversight of these projects, which are, you know, as you said, you know, billions of dollars. The interesting element here is it was the Pew Charitable Trust, very, very trusted, independent, nonpartisan organization that came up with the same conclusion. A lot of good government groups have, and a lot of press reports have shown.
Do you think that procurement reform is going to be something that's going to get addressed by the end of the legislative session? We're casting around right now for things that might get dealt with by the end of the legislative session.
I think we're starting to see the early stages of what the big ugly will be in June, and it's going to involve extending mayoral control of New York City schools. The Republican Senator Flanagan said that he was going to make sure that charter school expansion was part of that. That's going to be a big fight. Procurement reform could be part of this, but, you know, I want to see how it happens. You could see it as a leverage tool in negotiations. When a push comes to shove, I'm not sure the legislature is going to be that interested in getting it, but we'll see.
Well, we've seen some interest certainly on the Republican Senate side. The Assembly, we don't know.
Mike, you mentioned boosting the cap on charter schools, which clearly the Senate Republican majority would like to see. And they're going to clearly tie it to the question of mayoral control of New York City schools, which allows them, of course, to put the jab into Mayor Bill de Blasio, especially in his potentially re-election effort year. There's a certain amount of gamesmanship, more than a little bit of gamesmanship here. Mayor Bloomberg got a six-year extension of mayoral control. For de Blasio, mainly due to the Senate Republicans, he's just been getting one-year extensions all along. Is this going to become essentially a kind of new trade, like we hear about tax incentives for developers in New York City and the extension of tenants' rent control laws?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Because remember, when Bloomberg got his six-year extension, the Democrats were opposed to that. So it's become a situation of not a policy issue of whether the mayor should have responsibility for New York City schools to this extent. It's become a political issue of who the mayor is at the time. And if we get another one-year extension, which would be unfortunate in public policy because you need more certainty than that. If we get another one-year extension, then I think it's exactly what you're saying. We're going to look at this as an annual fight that's going to bring in a lot of disparate policies as well.
Bill de Blasio is like that athlete who's looking for that long-term deal, but all he gets is the one-year extension. Mike's right. Politically, it's really something to see.
Currently, 216 charters in the city. There are 30 slots left down there. 406 is the current state cap. The governor, of course, is a big supporter of charters. This kind of is a win-win for him in that it takes a shot at Mayor de Blasio and it allows him to be kind to his charter supporters.
Right. As far as numbers, there's also a big waiting list for charter schools in New York, Buffalo, a lot of other places too. But, you know, as I hope to not ever become cynical, I will note that we've got an awful lot of money involved on both sides of this. The charter school people who support the governor and support the Senate Republicans want this as a major priority. The mayor has the backing of unions and of the Assembly on his mayoral control. So we've got a lot of campaign contributions that come from any type of fight with this.
The governor, of course, was on tour, as he has been for the last couple of weeks. The victory lap for this state budget seems to be particularly a long road.
Yeah, and when does it end? We were talking about this before we started here. You know, we're getting close to a month now. And we were talking about how in 2011, when Governor Cuomo first took the reins here, after the budget was done, his mantra was like, okay, it's back to work. But as we know, and we talked about a couple weeks ago, he basically said, well, there's really not much left to do.
Everything's done.
And we mentioned this last week, you know, this victory tour has been one glaring omission geographically in New York, and that's the southern tier. He's been to Rochester multiple times, been to Long Island, he's even been up to Lake Placid, Buffalo. Southern tier is still waiting for a taste of that post-budget victory tour.
Yeah, he was in Albany just this week talking about criminal justice reform, which is a rare stop for him sort of outside of the capital, in the capital city. All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. So thanks very much to my partner, Matt Ryan, and of course to Mike Gormley. And we would be remiss if we did not mention this is Kentucky Derby weekend, lots of excitement at Churchill Downs. And I believe for the first time ever, there is a horse named Gormley in the run for the roses.
Yes. Look at that beautiful beast.
We have a shot of him from my Times Union colleague, Skip Dickstein, who is down at the track. I think all of our viewers can tell from looking at that shot that that horse is clearly a champion and, like his namesake, a terrific journalist. All right. Well, during his post-budget tour of the state, Governor Cuomo consistently touted the passage of ride-sharing as a big victory for upstate and Long Island. Matt Hamilton of the Times Union does a deep dive into the legislation, including when it begins, how it may affect the traditional taxi cab industry, and what changes may still come.
Sometimes it doesn't take much to spark a feverish debate at the state capitol, but for much of the past year, it took little more than the movement of one finger to spark a thorny policy battle.
Ayes 46, nays 15.
Bill's passed.
As part of last month's state budget deal, ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft were authorized to begin operations upstate and on Long Island as soon as early July. At the very base level, users of ride-hailing apps may not see much of a change in getting from point A to point B, but there are unseen nuances to the new law that could have big impacts. There will be a 4% tax on rides. Another 2.5% assessment will help fund workers' compensation for drivers. Cities and counties of 100,000 people or more will have the option of opting out of allowing ride-hailing services. Every driver will be subject to criminal background checks, something that isn't required of traditional cab companies in some areas. And it will be the State Department of Motor Vehicles, not local governments, that will regulate ride-hailing, another provision that distinguishes that industry from traditional taxis. Still, for all its caveats, ride-hailing is what the public overwhelmingly asked for, with 75% of voters statewide in the April Siena College poll saying that ride-hailing will make New York better. That made those services politically popular, particularly upstate.
Well, I actually pulled up in a Lyft this morning, and bringing Uber and Lyft to upstate New York is essential. Downstate New York had it. Upstate New York didn't have it. Upstate New York matters also. You want to have a first-class economy. You want to have a first-class economy that brings tourists. You need Uber and Lyft. It's all around the country. People expect it when they come here, and now they have it.
Yet to say all of upstate will see Uber and Lyft drivers on their streets might be too big a promise, says Assemblyman Kevin Cahill, a prime sponsor of ride-hailing legislation.
Bottom line is that the Ubers of the world will go where the people are. They won't go because the law is written this way or that way. In fact, even before we passed this law, these transportation network companies could have operated in any jurisdiction in New York State, but that would have meant they would have had to play by the same rules as everyone else. They weren't willing to do that. Now they have their own set of rules. And their own set of rules says essentially, get your insurance, comply with our background check requirements, and do one or two other things, and you can set up business anywhere you want in the state of New York.
But the companies aren't backing off from the lofty promises made during an intense public awareness campaign.
Our mission is to provide affordable, reliable transportation to everyone, everywhere, as reliable as running water. And that means being in Kingston. It also means being in the North Country. It also means being in Westchester and New York City and Buffalo and Albany, and it means being in the entire state and the entire country. And so, you know, are we going to be able to launch in Kingston on July 9th? I don't know. Do we want to get that done before the end of the summer in Kingston? Yes, we do.
Still, New Yorkers might not have the option everywhere. Taxi associations are applying pressure in downstate suburban counties to get lawmakers there to exercise their opt-out powers. That pressure is particularly intense in Nassau and Suffolk counties on Long Island. In Westchester, County Executive Rob Astorino's office told the Journal News last month that they would be reviewing the new law and the state DMV's regulations, and some on the County Board of Legislators say they'll do the same. But opting out could be politically messy, given the wide public support. To that end, some upstate municipal executives, including Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner and Onondaga County Executive Joni Mahoney, have pledged in the press to let the statewide regulations govern ride-hailing within their borders. But even as ride-hailing arrives later this year, that doesn't mean the legislature may not look to further change the way in which these services operate.
While they are better and people and the public is better protected because of it, I think that it's something that will require us to revisit at some point in the future.
A state task force will be charged with analyzing how services operate and with making suggestions about best practices. That could include looking at how ride-hailing companies can better serve the disabled, who demanded that ride-hailing fleets be made 100% wheelchair accessible. That call went unheeded. Or that could mean the introduction of fingerprinting to the background check process, a popular issue pushed by the taxi industry. Fingerprinting has been a hot topic of ongoing discussions in other states, including New Jersey and Massachusetts. In Austin, Texas, officials made fingerprinting of drivers mandatory. That led Uber and Lyft to pull their business from the city. Cahill, the Assembly Insurance Committee chairman, says lawmakers also could reopen provisions related to minimum insurance limits that are required when drivers have the ride-hailing app on and when they have a customer in their car. There's precedent for that in California, where in 2015 lawmakers revised the limits after a 6-year-old girl was struck by an Uber driver as she crossed the street and was killed. Already there are legislative efforts in New York to amend the new law. State Senator Michael Ranzenhofer, an Erie County Republican, is sponsoring a bill to move up the law's implementation date to June 29th. Two Republicans in the Assembly want a May implementation. At the same time, Republican State Senators Tom Croce of Long Island and Sue Serino of Dutchess County are pushing legislation that would bar all registered Level 1 sex offenders from being able to drive for ride-hailing companies. Regardless of how the legislature might want to change the way ride-hailing operates, ride-hailing will bring changes to a well-established mode of transportation.
Taxi.
We're not against their product. Their product is good, but there may be other things that can happen, the unintended consequences of something like that.
David Manny, owner and president of Black and White Taxi Inc. in Troy, says he has spoken with cab drivers in cities and other states about ride-hailing and often hears that those services have harmed their business. In some areas, notably yellow cab-dominated New York City, traditional taxi owners have griped that medallion prices have significantly dropped off with the introduction of new transportation options. But taxi owners already are looking at ways to compete based on what they've seen elsewhere. The Buffalo News recently reported on one local taxi company's plans to launch an app, joining the ride-hailing market.
For us to put an app on your local phone, I don't think that's going to work. I think that really the choice of the young user will be they know Uber. Uber's been in the news every week, in every magazine, in every publication for so long. They've made a great marketing effort. And I don't think a local app will probably help.
Traditional cab companies also still have other business to offer, such as medical transport. Manny says he has no doubt that ride-hailing will erode a certain segment of his business, particularly that of college students who are glued to their smartphones. But he's bullish that his business has staying power.
Do I feel we're swimming upstream? We may be, but we've been fighters, and we know that if we put out a good product, good clean car, good safe car, good drivers, polite, it's really what the public wants for the most part, and we provide it, and we want to provide it better than the other guy. It will be a challenge, but we're up to it.
For New York Now, I'm Matthew Hamilton in Albany.
And that leads us to this week's New York Now poll question. How likely are you to utilize ride-sharing once it's implemented? Let us know by heading to our website. The address is on our screen, nynow.org. Last week, we asked, how would you rate President Trump's first 100 days? Of all the choices, more than three quarters, said terrible. A lot of votes on this one. Peter in Clifton Park said the first 100 days have been terrific. We finally have a hardworking president with managerial skills that can achieve goals on behalf of the American people. Karen in Shenango, watching on WSKG, he has accomplished what he said he would. Looking forward to the new tax relief for businesses and the middle class, something we don't see in New York State. David in Messina, watching on Mountain Lake PBS, voted terrible. He thinks he's still running a company rather than a government, in which he is unable to bully, though he is surely trying. And finally, John in Horseheads in the Southern Tier said, on his 100th day, President Trump said, it's a very rough system, it's an archaic system, it's a really bad thing for the country. So much for swearing to defend the Constitution. Thank you for your input. To vote this week, just head to nynow.org. While you're there, you can catch up on any of our past programs and follow links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. where our handle is at NYNow_PBS. You can also follow the daily activities in Albany by going to the Capital Confidential blog. It's on our site, and it's also at timesunion.com. This assemblyman is a practicing pharmacist and former mayor of the city of Cohoes. And you can also listen to our latest podcast, our New York Now Throwdown Trivia Battle between Keisha Klucke of Politico New York and Ashley Hupfel of City and State. You can listen at nynow.org, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts.
All right, and now for a preview of next week, we'll be including footage from a discussion that I'll be moderating called the 6-Week Forecast. This is going to be at the Hearst Media Center. It's the inaugural event. And it's going to be a discussion between Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan looking at what's to come for the rest of the legislative session.
Nice coup for the Times Union. That should be a good forum. When I heard about this, it got me to thinking what the chances would have been that Shelley Silver and Dean Skelos, their predecessors.
Far less likely.
Nothing against those two gentlemen, but they weren't as personable, as affable as Flanagan and Hastie are. They have a good relationship, so I think that should be a pretty good forum.
Usually people only see these guys talking together when they emerge from closed-door budget negotiations,
right.
So this will be very interesting. All right, and if folks are interested in attending, they can go to the Capital Confidential blog for more information on that. All right, I'm Casey Seiler.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching. We're going to leave you today with scenes from the state capitol, tulips everywhere here as we get into Mother's Day just a week away. We'll see you next week right here on your local PBS station.